You know those moments in history, the real pivot points. We get the what happened, but sometimes the how is, well, even more revealing.
Especially when faith, power, and empire collide.
Exactly. So today, in this deep dive, we're doing a kind of forensic autopsy on the Council of Chalcedon, 451 CE, specifically Session 2.
A really critical session.
Right. And our mission is to look at the official minutes, see the procedural issues, maybe the injustices that led to this huge schism with the Oriental Orthodox churches that, persists today.
Yeah, and starting that autopsy, it's fascinating how much this whole council was, well, driven by Emperor Marcion. An imperial mandate, really.
So not purely theological from the get-go.
Not entirely. His main goal seems to have been state unity and stability. Religious harmony was key to that, of course.
Okay.
And the records show the presidency wasn't just bishops. Prestigious laymen were effectively in charge, with Patrician Anatolius, the emperor's guy, leading.
Which suggests.
Well, it hints that maybe the big decisions were already made, behind the scenes.
So session two kicks off, and it's not an open debate.
Doesn't look like it. Anatolius, the chairman, straight up demanded a pure exposition of the faith, a new one.
And the bishops.
They actually pushed back, pretty strongly at first. The records say apparently unanimous opposition.
Really?
Yeah, they said things like, "No one makes a new exposition, nor do we attempt or presume to do so." They even cited Canon 7 of Ephesus's Psalm.
Which forbade new creeds.
And explicitly forbade them.
So what happened? Did he listen?
Nope. The chairman just ignored it, moved right ahead, formed a committee to draft a new statement anyway.
Wow, so how did they get around that canon, that explicit rule?
Well, this is where it gets, let's say, strategic.
Yeah.
They introduced the Creed of Constantinople from 381 CE.
Okay, an older creed.
But here's the thing. Commentary points out this creed is basically mentioned nowhere before Chalcedon itself.
Seriously.
Its sudden resurrection, as scholars put it, seems pretty clearly motivated by needing a precedent to justify making another new creed, almost like a historical back formation.
A calculated move, then. Okay, so turning our autopsy towards Dioscorus of Alexandria, big figure.
Huge. Patriarch of Alexandria.
He was deposed provisionally after session one, but then what happened in session two?
He was explicitly excluded, kept out of the room for the main doctrinal debate.
So no chance to defend his views or participate in formulating the doctrine?
None. A complete denial of a fair defense at that crucial stage. It basically guaranteed the confirmation of faith went ahead without his, frankly, powerful influence.
Were there objections to this?
There were some bishops called out, restore Dioscorus to the council. They were shouted down. Counter shouts of the Egyptian into exile. The atmosphere sounds pretty charged.
You mentioned his deposition was provisional. Was that adjusted later?
It seems so. The records suggest it was altered in retrospect. Made provisional after the fact, probably a legalistic maneuver to make his formal trial in session three look more legitimate, like ticking a box for due process.
An appearance of due process. Okay. Then there's Pope Leo's tome, major document.
Absolutely central. Rome's position on Christology.
It was read out, and the minutes say it got enthusiastic acclaim.
Yeah, supposedly. But commentary suggests that can scarcely have been unanimous.
Why not?
Well, there's evidence many bishops might have been, let's say, pressured into signing it before it was even publicly read in the session.
Signed beforehand. Okay, that changes the dynamic.
Right. And the minutes themselves seem condensed. They mention detailed discussion that was reduced in the record. So who knows what debates or objections got left out?
Interesting. Any other evidence suppressed?
There's a specific instance. During the dogmatic talks, one bishop asked for Cyril of Alexandria's third letter to Nestorius,
Which contained.
the controversial 12 chapters, really thorny theological points about Christ's
But did
nature.
they read it? Discuss it?
Nope. The request is noted and then silence. No further mention in the public sessions. Seems like a deliberate omission to keep the narrative clean, focused on Leo's tome, perhaps.
It paints a picture of, well, not exactly open theological inquiry. The records mention vigorous shouting, angry interjections.
Yeah, sounds like emotional manipulation. Maybe even mob pressure was part of the toolkit to shape the outcome. It wasn't just abstract theology.
Yeah.
Power was definitely in play.
Which brings us back to Dioscorus. He's eventually tried in session three.
Yes, formally tried, but in absentia. It wasn't there. Widely seen as a show trial.
But what about the other bishops deposed with him back in session one? There were five others, right?
That's a key point. Juvenal Jerusalem, Thalassius of Caesarea, and three others.
What happened to them?
Complete contrast. They were rehabilitated and reinstated in session four.
Even figures like Theodoret of Cyrrhus and Ibas of Edessa, who had views considered semi-Nestorian, they got back in too.
They did, over objections, actually, which really shows, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Theological consistency was bent to political will.
For imperial stability. Isolate Dioscorus, bring others back into the fold.
It looks very much like a political calculation by the new Emperor Marcian in Rome. Get rid of Dioscorus, short of support elsewhere.
So, wrapping up our forensic autopsy of session two, it reveals a process that seems, well, deeply compromised.
Definitely. Imperial goals, political maneuvering often seem to trump canonical rules and maybe even genuine theological discussion.
The exclusion of Dioscorus, the managed acceptance of Leo's tome, suppressing other texts, the selective rehabilitations, it points to a pattern.
A pattern of what feels like injustice, engineered to achieve a specific outcome.
And this outcome, this politically engineered compromise, wasn't just a theological statement. It had massive consequences.
Absolutely. It's fundamental to understanding that lasting, deep schism with the Oriental Orthodox churches. They saw this council, particularly how Dioscorus and Cyril's legacy were treated, as a betrayal.
It really makes you think. When we look back at a moment like this, where you can see power dynamics, imperial politics shaping religious doctrine so profoundly, what does that suggest to you about how external forces, politics, power might influence institutions, beliefs, even today? Something to consider.